content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Nicole Hunter from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Essence Magazine, November 2018 edition. And this is actually the last week of November. So yay, we're almost in December. So we're going to continue on with the section of It's Our Time to Heal, where some of the writers are telling about their sexual harassment experiences. So this next one that we're going to cover, it's from Essence Op-Ed on My Mind. I muted R. Kelly. Why did I continue to listen to R. Kelly's songs long after supporting his music became a problem? It took my own experience with sexual assault to finally realize the truth. And this article was written by Aaliyah S. King. In the summer of 1984, I was sexually assaulted by a 17-year-old counselor. I was 12 years old. The counselor was from my hometown, and I saw him every day at camp, and then every day in school for the next year until he graduated. Like many young girls, I couldn't quite figure out how the incident made me feel. In many ways, I still can't. I didn't want to tell anyone because I was sure that it was somehow my fault. I just took a deep breath and went to school each day. The assault was awful on its own. But then I had to walk by him in the halls and see him at football games or in the cafeteria. He never said a word to me. He didn't have to. I continued to feel abused by him every time I encountered him. I never saw him after he graduated, but I heard his name from my friends. I knew he had gone to college and become a respected leader of the community. He eventually popped up on Facebook, on my Facebook feed, commenting on a post from a mutual friend. I clicked on his profile and fell down the rabbit hole of seeing his entire life. He had married, had children, bought a house, and held a high position in the church. I had hot tears on my face as I saw how normal he seemed. I think I wanted him to be clearly a monster. I wanted to see a mugshot, not a Christmas photo of a cheery family in a matching pajamas, not an apparently decent man, a loving husband, and a doting dad whose church members appeared to be faithful acolytes. If I saw this man on the street today, would I say a word to him? Absolutely not. Would I visit his church? Never. For me, this man is canceled forever since 1984. I wouldn't say I hate him, but I would never want anything to do with him, his family, his friends. I know exactly what canceling someone looks like. And when it came to my abuser, I had no problem doing so. I was lucky. My attacker wasn't a relative. He wasn't someone I had to see every day for years. He also wasn't a beloved public figure who was consistently in the media. If my attacker had been R. Kelly, would I listen to his music? Absolutely not. I wouldn't be able to stomach a single note. I wouldn't be able to watch his videos or see him perform. He would be canceled. Instead, I was able to compartmentalize my own situation and heal from it in silence and peace. When social justice activist Kenyette Tish Barnes and arts administrator Aronike Adoye launched the hashtag #MuteRKelly movement in July 2017, their goal was simple: keep him off airwaves and streaming services and shut down his live performances. Considering my own experiences, one would think I would have decided to hashtag mute R. Kelly back in the 90s, but I didn't. As a reporter and a journalist, I've long known about R. Kelly's alleged marriage to the late singer Aaliyah in 1994, when she was just 15. And in the early 2000s, the office where I worked received a copy of the alleged videotape at the center of his child pornography trial. I saw the tape with my own eyes. After more allegations that now span decades and a 2008 acquittal in the child pornography case, it's clear that R. Kelly has been problematic for his entire career. And yet I still listen to his music. Why wouldn't I? The man has been called a musical genius, serving as a bridge from classic soul artists like Sam Cooke and Stevie Wonder. Of course, celebrity worship has always been a tricky game, and one could argue that R. Kelly was no different from so many others. We can run down a list of musicians and problematic personal lives for a number of reasons from the beginning of time and continue to present day. I grew up loving Marvin Gaye, then I read about one of his ex-wives' account of their relationship and was appalled. But I didn't mute him. I separated the artist from the art. Then I got married and had a daughter. As she grew and I began to hone my mama bear instincts, I had to have uncomfortable but necessary conversations with my child to protect her from sexual predators. By then, when R. Kelly's music came across my playlist, I would feel uncomfortable. But my daughter loved to sing I Believe I Can Fly, which she learned in pre-K, so I continued to separate the artist from the art. In 2004, I got press tickets for R. Kelly and Jay-Z's concert for their Best of Both Worlds tour. They were two of my favorite acts. Seeing them together doing joint and separate sets would be a dream come true. I got a date and a date night outfit and headed to New York City's Madison Square Garden. On my way into the show, I remember thinking briefly about everything I had heard about R. Kelly, all the way back to the Aaliyah rumors. When my date and I walked past the marquee, I looked up, saw the signage, and felt a twinge of something at the sight of R. Kelly's name. I now know it was a twinge of guilt, but I packed it away and went to the show. I had a good time. We all did. Most of us in the invited audience of elected officials, celebrities, and journalists knew what had been said about R. Kelly. Many of us had even reported on it, but we didn't walk away from him as an artist. My own reasoning went something like this. I hadn't paid money to see him, so I wasn't really supporting him. In hindsight, I realized it was a lame excuse. But at the time, my cognitive dissonance allowed me to feel as if I had made it had made sense. I am now 44 and in my 20th year as a journalist. As a mother of two daughters, I am protective to a fault. As a music consumer and a writer, I'm also more discerning about whom and what I choose to report on and in what context. That's because as the hashtag MeToo movement took hold, I could not make excuses anymore. R. Kelly wasn't my abuser, but how would I feel if my abuser was the pastor of a mega church my family attended, or if he were an author whose work was read and praised by many? Would I separate the minister from the message? Would I separate the writer from the words? And what if my abuser had continued to abuse other women for years, and it was an open secret that my entire community just shrugged it off? I would be devastated. I finally understand that this is exactly what's happening to scores of black women who have reported that R. Kelly abused them in various ways. These women live in a world that simply doesn't seem to care about their allegations. A world that separates the artist from the art. A world in which people shrug off their accusations and blame them for being fast and inviting their own abuse. These days, I'm firmly on the hashtag mute R. Kelly train. Yes, that means not stepping on the name of love at the family reunion. It also means asking the Uber driver to change the station when R. Kelly comes on the radio. It doesn't take money out of his pocket, but it keeps us aware. When my Uber driver asked me why I wanted to change the station, I told him. He was quiet for a moment and then asked more questions. This is how change happens. The next time, maybe he'll turn it off on his own. It's not that difficult to hashtag mute R. Kelly and to make my position known. Skipping his performances and concerts is simple. So is deleting his songs from my music library and streaming playlists. This matters. The music I play in my home and when my daughters are listening matters. It makes me think about why I'm not playing his songs and about other artists who need to be counseled too. Right is right and wrong is wrong, and I'm way too late to this campaign. But better than never, because power in numbers has always been the source of our progress. From slave revolts to civil rights sit-downs or sit-ins to hashtag me too. Though I finally hit the hashtag mute R. Kelly button, it should have been sooner. I think many will say the same as the movement continues to grow. There's no room for nuance for me anymore. The truth is, there never was. So, my daughter's sake for women everywhere, I will no longer separate the artist from the art. And again, this article was written by Aaliyah S. King. She's an award-winning author and a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in Essence and Miss. So continuing on with this conversation, the next article that we're going to go over is The Right to Heal. This is reclaiming your body after trauma is a personal process, but you don't have to do it alone. Recovery can take many forms and unfolds differently for everyone. Here, advocates around the country offer wisdom to help Black women heal after experiencing sexual assault. First, remember that you are not to blame. So many of us want to speak up, but we don't, says Levon Pico, aka Proverbs, a preacher, poet, and social entrepreneur who lives in Oakland. Her online platform, Beautiful Scars, WeSurvivors.com, provides a community for Black women who are survivors of male sexual violence. She notes that when women see how other survivors are treated, it causes them to remain silent. Often people blame the victim, says Pica. So first realize that what happened to you was wrong and it wasn't your fault. Give yourself permission to get better. Healing is a birthright, says YOLO Akil Robinson. She's the founder of BEAM, which is Black Emotional and Mental Health Collective. The Los Angeles-based nonprofit focuses on fostering mental health literacy, securing and distributing funding to help make care more accessible, and developing leaders for the purpose of helping Black people nationwide heal. Too often we feel like we can't honor our emotions and our feelings, and we have to push past the pain, Robinson says. That logic keeps us from being or really understanding that our feelings matter. What's going on in our heart matters. What happens to us matters. It may be hurtful to try journaling your emotions and scheduling a time to check in on how you are feeling on a regular basis. Know that it takes time. As much as we'd like to, we can't snap our fingers and make our trauma disappear. It's important to recognize healing as a journey and an active practice. Healing is nonlinear, says Abaku Utah, the founder of Harriet's Apothecary, a Brooklyn-based healing collective committed to self-care. It is lifelong, and it's always changing because we're changing. The conditions around us are changing our bodies. Our bodies are changing. Our needs are changing. Some days will be better than others, but that's okay. Define your own process. In her work with survivors, Utah has tapped into a number of practices, including meditation, plant-based medicine, breathe work, dance and grieving rituals. It's really important to start slow and not necessarily sign up for everything, she suggests. Begin with just noticing at this moment how you are breathing. What's the impact that being in a particular space has on your breath, your heart, and your ability to move within that space? There's more than one way to heal. Feel free to add new practices and leave behind the ones that no longer serve you. You have the power to decide how your process looks and do what feels good to you. Break the silence. A confidant is important in all stages of life, but especially when you are unloading a traumatic experience. When you're ready, find someone you can trust, one person who you can tell your story to and they will believe you, says Pico. Take your time deciding on whom you will confide in. It may be a different person that you're used to sharing with. Your story is your story and no one else's, she says. You have the right to share your own truth even if your voice shakes. Connect with your ancestors. You are standing on the shoulders of women who have persevered. We teach people to remember their history because we believe history heals, says Camilla Johnson, founder and executive director of the SASHA, Sexual Assault Survivors for Holistic Healing and Awareness Center in Detroit. The organization provides clients with a range of activities to participate in, including Afro-Cuban dance, drumming circles, and historical tours. What makes tracing our history so beneficial is that it allows you to recognize the strength of those who came before you and to acknowledge that you have the same strength in your DNA. Love on your body. Get involved in physical activity so that you're comfortable being in your body, advises Pico, who also is a spin instructor. Taking dance classes, walking, boxing, gardening, and other activities can help survivors reclaim their bodies and start to be at peace in their skin once again. Pico also suggests establishing daily rituals. Look at your body in the mirror, know that you are safe, and tell yourself out loud how much you love your body. You've got support. These organizations offer training professionals offer trained professionals who can help you navigate the stages of your healing. Black Women's Blueprint, and this is a nonprofit that works towards social, political, and economic equity for women of African descent. Their programs include crisis intervention and healing circles. MeToo.movement, it helps survivors, particularly young women of color from low wealth communities, find pathways to healing. Find more than 1,000 resources. National Sexual Assault Telephone Hotline. This is where you can call 800-656-HOPE. Again, that's 800-656-HOPE. 24/7 to be connected to a local organization. The person on the other end will confidentially walk you through what happened and make referrals. Other resources you can head to therapyforblackgirls.com to find a mental health professional in your area. Also, psychologytoday.com has an online directory that allows you to filter therapists by race, gender, and expertise. Continuing on with this segment of It's Our Time to Heal. Why I'm changing the conversation around sex education for women. Brittany Braithwaite, co-founder of the sex ed startup Kim Britov, explains what it means to be a reproductive justice activist. I've never had formal sex education. The first time I was ever tested for HIV was when I wandered into a mobile testing unit parked on the corner of my block in Brooklyn. I wanted the free Metro card they were giving away in exchange for me learning my status. At 18, I had no idea what the process entailed, and I didn't know whether I was at risk, even though I was already having sex. I never forgot that moment. It was a wake-up call to me that something was missing, and I wanted to be involved in filling the gap in college. I began doing sex education work focused on HIV/AIDS for students of color on Syracuse University's campus. I was so moved by the cause that I applied for a program called the Young Women of Color Leadership Council through the nonprofit Advocates for Youth. The Young Women of Color is where I learned a lot about HIV/AIDS, especially its impact on Black women and other women of color. It's also where I discovered what it meant to be a reproductive justice activist. I had heard about reproductive justice, but until that point, I thought it was focused strictly on abortion. I found out that it was about more than just abortion or choice. How can you have reproductive choice if you don't have access to birth control? Yes, you may be able to choose something, but if you don't have access to it, you don't truly have a choice. I identified strongly with the broader idea of what it meant to be an activist in this place. So I co-founded Kimbrative, a company that provides sex ed workshops and consulting in 2015 with Kimberly Huggins, one of my best friends. We envision a world where everyone, especially Black and brown women and girls, has unfettered access to power, to resources, to the support they need to make informed and unapologetic decisions about their bodies and identities. I didn't have that as a child. My parents died when I was 5, so as I grew up being raised by relatives, a lot of decisions were made on my behalf by other people. As a survivor of gender-based violence, I know how important it is to be able to make my own decisions about my identity and my body. The Kimbrative, we begin the sex ed conversation with Black and brown women and girls and non-binary folks, those who do not exclusively identify as male or female. I know some people will say, oh, they're just talking, but there's so much freedom in doing so. Take #MeToo, for example. People sharing their stories and having them be received and believed opens up so many possibilities for them to take back something they may have felt had been taken from them. We see the same thing when it comes to sex. When people are finally able to name what they actually desire or name what hurts or name what is missing, there's an opening. An opening to ask your partner different questions. Ask your doctor different questions. Teach your children different things. It all starts with sharing one's experience. I believe it's important for those of us in sex education to insert ourselves more deeply into the #MeToo conversation. I've seen that there's a divergence between teaching about sex and teaching about sexual violence. It's important. It's either we're going to teach kids about the birds and the bees, or we're going to teach this bad thing from happening. But part of the sexual health is having consensual and pleasurable sex, which means not having unpleasurable or unconsensual relations. We have to bridge these conversations and give people the tools to talk about them. We need to know what gives us pleasure and what hurts us emotionally and physically. I didn't have this information growing up, and my hope is that it can be a reality for every child. So here's a final word written by Gabrielle Union. Healing all our costs. Healing at all costs. As she filtered her pain to spare others, feeling about her survival as a victim of sexual violence. This actress, activist, and author delayed her own recovery until now. When I was raped at 19, I had a boyfriend. After the assault, it was never just about me dealing with surviving rape. It was about surviving rape and dealing with my man and his feelings of emasculation. There was also my dad who was like, "You broke my thing." This is all in the first week with my eyes still swollen shut and my face messed up from the beating. Immediately, my pain is decentered because there were bigger fish to fry in my mind. It was like, here's your crash course in living with PTSD. Anything could be a trigger, anything. A door closes. I always felt like someone was sneaking up on me when they're really just walking into a room and I just didn't hear them. I'm constantly having to decenter my pain and what that looks like entirely to make other people comfortable with living, functioning, loving a rape survivor. To do that, I have literally seen my therapist, counselor, spiritual healer, psychiatrist, shaman, and life coach I could. But in the past years, I've given myself permission to center my own healing. I'm amplifying my pain, which I had never done. When I started emptying out my basket of stuff, I had to get used to saying, I cannot think about how you think of me or how my rape has impacted you. I'm no longer centering that because it actually causes a pivot in healing. I would spend half my therapy session talking about other people, not me, and that's not really helpful. I gravitate toward spaces where there is implied silence. That's why I really love libraries and bookstores, because my silence isn't weird there. I'm okay. One day in a bookstore, I discovered Darnella Ford's Rising. I was struck by the woman on the cover. She had dreads. She's sitting cross-legged, hugging herself, and she's presumably naked. Years later, when I was experienced one of those times when I felt like I was just circling the drain, my girlfriend said, I think this woman, Darnella, can really help you. I go to her place for counseling, and there's a point in our session where we do a guided meditation, and I see the book. Even though I had been in her house for 2 hours, it's only then I realized that she's the author of Rising. She tells me that she has switched careers and now runs this wellness program called Journey to Worthy. Whether I see Darnella 2 or 3 times a week, there have been those weeks or once every few months, she always gets me back on my own worthiness journey. We talk about the Me Too movement. We talk about why I didn't report. We talk about how I decentered my pain, trauma, and healing because I felt worthy of wholeness. Because no one tells Black women we are worthy of wholeness. We tell Black women you're a real one if you shoulder the pain. If there's anything I could say to my fellow survivors, it's center your own pain. It's okay to use the whole hour to talk about it. It's okay to phone a friend and delve into your pain and really focus on your wholeness and your worthiness and your soul. Center your soul. When I started centering my wholeness and centering my soul, my peace, my health, the world opened up. And this was so eloquently written by actress, activist, and author Gabrielle Union. So we've run out of time for this week's episode of Essence Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Nicole Hunter, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, www.trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.